Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good evening and welcome to the Commonwealth Club of California Bay Gourmet program. I'm Amy Sherman of Cooking with Amy, and I'll be the moderator for tonight's panel, A New National Food Policy, But What About the Hungry? The panelists this evening are A.G. Kawamura, Secretary of the California Department of Food and Agriculture, Paul Ash, Executive Director of the San Francisco Food Bank, Paula Jones, Director of Food Systems for the San Francisco Department of Public Health, and Michael Dimock, President of Roots of Change. A.G. Kawamura was appointed by Governor Schwarzenegger as the secretary in November 2003. He is a produce grower and shipper from Orange County, where he grew up. His family grows strawberries, green beans, and other specialty crops. And he is widely known for his passion for education and his commitment to the issues of hunger and nutrition. Paul Ash has a degree in agricultural economics. He worked in the private sector and has also worked in nonprofit for 20 years, 18 of which have been spent at the San Francisco Food Bank. His commitment to ending hunger in San Francisco has enabled the growth of the food bank to skyrocket in recent years, earning the organization the Nonprofit Corporate Growth Award in 2001. Paula Jones is at the Department of Public Health here in San Francisco. She focuses on health equity, sustainability, and planning for San Francisco's food system. She was raised on a family farm, so she certainly knows about agriculture as well. Michael Dimock is the president of Roots of Change, which is a nonprofit organization whose purpose is to spawn a sustainable food system in California by the year 2030. He has a background in working for a multinational agribusiness company, but has really turned his focus to sustainable agriculture in recent years. Thanks to each of the panelists. This program came about because of a piece in the New York Times by Michael Pollan called An Open Letter to the Next Farmer in Chief, and it addressed many of the ideas for reforming the food system, but it didn't mention anything about feeding the hungry. And here in San Francisco, one in four children and one in four seniors don't have access to enough food to meet their nutritional needs on a regular basis. And an estimated 150,000 people are living at or below 150% of the poverty level, which means they struggle as well for enough food daily. So today's discussion is really about how the current thinking about food policy affects accessibility. My goal is that we explore the possibilities and the challenges for making good food accessible to everyone and really focus on solutions, what each of us as private citizens and government officials can do to make it a reality. So starting with the Secretary, A.G. Kawamura, in so many ways, California really leads the nation. We lead in terms of emission laws, civil rights, even health care. So what happens here is really important for the rest of the nation. From your department's perspective, what can you tell us about efforts to address hunger at the state level?
There's so many different ways in which government and the nonprofits out there are trying to deal with hunger, trying to feed folks. And I would say, unfortunately, one of the challenges is there are silos of efforts throughout the state, whether it's the WIC program, food stamps, school lunch programs. You have Veterans Affairs that's feeding seniors. You have any number of corrections is a perfect example of yet another government feeding program, feeding the prisoners of the state. And yet none of those are necessarily all working together on any given day to help really converge, if you will, those efforts towards dealing with hunger and nutrition. I think maybe it's important to make sure that we understand that nutrition or malnutrition, eating too much or not enough, those are symptoms. Hunger is a symptom of malnutrition, as is obesity. And so much of what we deal with, I think, in terms of looking at solutions for hunger from the state level revolve around two areas. This idea of having compassion and wanting to make sure that we can work with the needy in our state, and that, for example, the many, many goals of many organizations that no child should go to bed hungry, among others. And then more importantly, this challenge of nutrition, eating a good, solid, nutrient-dense diet that doesn't lead to other problems. And so many agencies are working in those arenas, and I think what's starting to happen is a recognition that we have to start working a lot closer together, especially during times of tight resources, to try and find a solution set. And I'm hopeful dialogues like these help actually make that happen.
Michael Dimock, from your perspective, what is the state doing right when it comes to hunger?
Well, one of the most exciting things, actually, is begun in the last few days. The federal government provides to the state of California something called a specialty block grant for the promotion of specialty crops. The secretary, and with support, I'm sure, from the governor, and has decided that those monies can parts of those monies can be used now for nutrition purposes. Traditionally, most of that money was used for marketing and research, more crop-oriented issues. I think one of the things that the secretary has brought is this real focus on nutrition, which is very timely because we have a federal government that's now USDA really focused. So there's some synergy there. So I would say that that's a really positive thing that's emerging right now. Another thing is that there are groups all around the state who are interested in working in collaboration. In the same way the secretary described the state government's trying to do. There are NGOs at the community level, neighborhood level, city level, regional level, who are trying to figure out how to more efficiently work together. And I think the food banks, and you'll hear from Paul, that there's a lot of really interesting things going on. One last thing I'll mention is that political leaders in cities are engaging. Paula was part of working with actually the secretary and Paul, in something called the Urban Rural Roundtable here in the city. And one of the foci that the mayor illuminated or tasked that roundtable with doing was figuring out a way to link the farmers in the region within 200 miles with efforts, programs that would bring better nutrition and healthy food to the people of San Francisco. So those are things that are emerging that are really positive and I think will have huge impacts.
Paula Jones, what can you tell us about what the city is doing to sort of discourage the junk food and encourage the healthier, affordable food?
There's several things. I think that the city and, you have the city government and you have the school district, and for many years now, the school district has taken a really proactive role in trying to institute policies that govern the school food environment. So making sure that all the junk food is out, making sure that the children have access to higher quality food for more nutrient-dense food. There's still challenges in that arena, and we'll probably get to those a little bit later. But I think that the school district has definitely put some policies in place that will improve the school food environment and what the children have access to. And the city has several different initiatives. Last year, we did implement a law regarding menu labeling and just trying to make more nutritional information available at restaurants. And this year, we'll be rolling out the state version of that. We've also got some initiatives. One is called the Mayor's Shape Up Initiative, that really looks at the city sort of citywide and really motivating. It's a collaboration between city government and community and looking at how we can create environments that provide more access to healthy food and then more access to sort of ability to have physical activity that's safe. So the city's doing a few things, I think, really well. I mean, we also are a pretty good place to pilot things. And in general, so there's food stamp innovations that sometimes get piloted in San Francisco. So there's a real environment of innovation. I think things can happen here in terms of policy. And I was just on the phone with someone else thinking ideas through today about some other policies we might be able to sort of try here that would improve access to food stamps, things like that.
Paul Ash, from your perspective, what you see with the hungry that are served by the San Francisco Food Bank, what are the challenges to a healthy diet?
Well, food banks, and I think of Feeding America food banks throughout California, were sort of responders to, first, the needs of our clients, the literally millions of people in California who can't afford to buy enough food for themselves, But also, we're responders to the marketplace. What are the resources that we can bring to bear to that issue for our clients? And as responders, you have to shift with the marketplace. In the 80s, we looked at the excess of manufactured food and packaged food, and we did a pretty good job of rounding that up and getting it into our warehouses and distributing it. As that has sort of leveled out, or in some cases declined, we've now worked more with farmers and growers and packers and shippers to get fresh produce in. So we're sort of users of what the economy gives us, and we try to marry that with the programs that the government provides, and really try to put that patchwork that's sometimes called a safety net. A net sounds very organized. Unfortunately, the safety net is kind of disorganized, and we're one of the disorganized pieces trying to keep people from flowing through. And that's the way we work to try to get nutrition into families' diets in San Francisco.
Michael Dimock, when I took a look at the food declaration that you had, I noticed that you did address hunger and that issue. And I'm wondering, as food systems do change and we move away from some of the industrial programs that are in place and some of the potentially the farm subsidies, what's going to happen in terms of replacing that surplus food that has been a resource for food banks and a resource for those at the bottom?
Well, it's an important question. I don't actually believe that the people of this country, the government, will stop providing monies to farmers. I think that the incentives that currently exist will change. So I think that it is possible that the supply of food that will not be affected in a negative way by the subsidy system. I think the issue that will really affect food supply is water, and possibly farmers. Actually, the availability of farmers to farm the land. Those are two big kind of structural things that we should all be thinking about. I think another interesting thing that I think is very important for more than just the food supply, but also for the changing of consciousness, I think there's going to be more urban agriculture emerging. You're seeing it now. I just watched a kind of a rough cut of a beautiful little film called Edible Cities that's being produced by some filmmakers over in the East Bay. And they've shot, actually, Alamany Farm here, a bunch of stuff going on over in Oakland, some stuff up north. Really beautiful film about the emergence or the reemergence of agriculture back into communities. And I think it's important because one of the underlying causes of the problems we have in the food system today is that urban people, which are now greatly dominate the system, have forgotten the connection and the importance of agricultural producers and the task of producing food. And so the reintroduction of these farming systems into the city, even if they're little, is really important for shaping consciousness and also allowing communities that have been devastated by poverty and structural racism, all the things that go on to keep places poor. I think that the ability for people to produce food is an empowering and important thing that will both feed them physically but also intellectually and emotionally. So that's how I think it will... I don't see that federal policy is going to eliminate the surpluses that are leading to food production. I think we're going to pay farmers, hopefully, for different things than we're paying for now.
A.G. Kawamura, how do you see this urban gardening phenomenon?
You know, I had a chance growing up and farming still in Orange County to watch the demise of a really amazing agricultural arena area, one of the top places on the planet, coastal Mediterranean plain, great soils, most of it now under asphalt and cement, and you realize that what a missed opportunity when we don't recognize what a resource is. And that resource coupled with, I think, an understanding, of whether it's garden-based learning or whether it's just an understanding of how nature works, I think is a very critical part of why agriculture as we know it is vulnerable in many ways. If we forget some of those hard-learned lessons, it's hard then to support just even the act of agriculture in all its different manifestations, big and small. And I know I'm regularly worried about things like invasive species and the other things that happen with global climate change. We just seem to understand that unpredictable weather means unpredictable harvest, and that's whether you're big or small, whether on a continent basis, these are not good things. So putting that in a perspective, I think where we see the urban populations, I'm a big believer in edible landscaping. I've seen mm-hmm. it happen. One of the newest plantings of oranges in Orange County happens to be on the incredible edible park down there, a project we have with one of the food banks. That we recognize we could custom grow food for the local food banks and really work with our NGOs and make those types of things happen. Whenever you see something growing, all the landscape within a city, it can be edible. You have to water it, you have to deal with it and take care of it like anything else. And agriculture being kind of a nurturing activity, it fits well to start to look at what are those resources in an urban area. San Diego County, you'd be surprised to know, is one of the top 10 agricultural counties in the country, with more farmers per capita than any other place in the country. Last time I looked at those statistics, and what you see is a lot of folks being able to find something that grows avocados and flowers and some of the other many crops that can grow in that kind of a climate. So I think the urban forest, if you will, has got great potential. Permaculture on the home level, where you grow your own food at your own house. Community gardens, school gardens, we're very focused on that. And I think you're going to see that in tandem with a resurgence of, I guess, an agricultural renaissance. That's where I know our Ag Vision process wants to see us, similar to the Roots of Change new mainstream, is we have to kind of really know where we're going in the future here. By the year 2030, 2050, there's some very important things that need to come together.
You are listening to a Commonwealth Club program, a new national food policy, but what about the hungry? With panelists Paul Ash, A.G. Kawamura, Secretary, Paula Jones, and Michael Dimock. So, Paula Jones, this urban gardening phenomenon, how is San Francisco getting involved with this?
You know, San Francisco, the city, has had a really long history, I think, of supporting urban agriculture. I often talk with people from across the country, and they're pretty amazed at how the city has supported it. Number one, we have a lot of community gardens on city property, whether it be PUC land, park and rec land, and the city, in a lot of cases, pays for the water of that. The city has funded in the past the building of gardens and community gardens, and at this point, the Department of the Environment has a great program called the Victory Garden Program that's rolling out backyard gardens. And there's also a project, a garden registry project, to have people come in and register their gardens so that we can start to understand what kind of urban production that we're having. And then the city has actually, if you're residents, thank you for doing this, passed two different bonds that included the greening of schoolyards. And so at this point, we have institutional funding for the greening of schoolyards. And, you know, always the maintenance of them is always a challenge, but we have a great alliance called the Green Schoolyard Alliance that's rolling out the bond money and building new school gardens all the time. So, you know, I think that we can always do more, but I think that the city has really supported urban agriculture. I think even, you know, having the Victory Garden across from City Hall during Slow Food Nation really was a big statement, and it definitely has taken off. As we can see, it's sort of, you know, now others are doing it too.
Paul Ash, we've heard some of the positives to this urban gardening, but what about the shortcomings in terms of, you see the volume of folks who need support? Where do you see this fitting into the overall picture?
Well, I think urban gardens, especially in schools, is a terrific opportunity. It's a great way for children not only to learn about gardening and nature and science and math, but it creates a nice environment for them. But I think we need to be careful not to create the idea that poor people can feed themselves through urban gardening. There are a lot of challenges to being part of a low-income family. You know, I think we all expect low-income people to be finding solutions to get back on track and to become part of the fabric of society, where you buy your food like everyone else in society does. So I think we need to make a distinction between values that urban gardening can make and think about what people can realistically create for themselves as they try to deal with their own poverty. If I just look at the amount of produce that we distribute here in San Francisco, it's 8 or 10 tractor trailer loads a week. So the idea that could be grown by people who live in housing that's very dense and communities that sometimes people don't feel safe in, That's a stretch. So I think we want to decide what urban gardening can do for us and help it do that, but not expect it to do something special for low-income people.
Where are some of the other solutions that you would like to see, both at a city and a state level, to really help provide more for the folks that you serve?
Well, there's no shortage of opportunities. On the government side, the food stamp program, the state of California is number 51 out of 51, you have to include District of Columbia, in terms of getting people who are eligible for food stamps signed up. So we have a huge opportunity there. School meals, another big opportunity. Nobody likes what they see in school meals here in San Francisco, and that's true in most school districts of the state. Another great opportunity, and that's, of course, in front of the Congress just this year. Opportunities to work more closely with growers. We were talking about that earlier today. There's lots of opportunities today in California to bring the excess from agriculture to bear to help low-income people. And that's, of course, when I read the letter to the First Farmer, my antenna went up. Well, gee, if the surplus goes away, if prices of produce go up, what are we going to do? Our leg of the stool that we're providing now for low-income people would be threatened. So we want to be at that table. We want low-income people's concerns to be at the table as the agricultural production system shifts.
So it sounds like we can't go anywhere but up as far as our food stamps program. There's room for improvement. And where do you see that improvement? Where would you like to see the food stamps program go, A.G. Calmora? What is your vision for the food stamps program?
When you go back to the original food stamp program, as I understand it, when it was first really put into play, it was because young men that were joining up and trying to get into the Army coming out of the Great Depression were so malnourished they couldn't pass the physical, and the U.S. government said, that's not good. This is the infrastructure of a nation that to defend itself. We better figure out how to create a program that will make sure that they can build a strong enough body so they can go out there and fight. So the original drive behind food stamps, now there were soup lines and soup kitchens and other things during the Great Depression, but the original food stamp program, if you think about it, was a nutrition program. And I think so, recognizing that there's kind of two things. I think the goal of agriculture globally, nationally, should be to statewide, should be to create abundance. Government can help make sure that abundance is distributed and distributed to a point where we should. How is it possible that California, the number one ag state, hasn't been able to end hunger? How is it possible that San Francisco or Orange County, where I came from, was always a goal? How can we get to a point where we can end hunger in one area? And once you do it in one place, why can't you do it and start to make that spread out everywhere else? Bringing the resources then to bear that come with all these different feeding programs, I've always felt that wouldn't it be wonderful if we started to converge those together and started to link them together with the natural processes that an agricultural system has. How you do that or where that convergence resides, that can go any place. But I think the idea is if we're going to try and make sure to get people back on their feet, if we're going to try and make sure that the nutrition package they have, the numbers that we keep on hearing from the health community is, and we argue about this, but it's 98% of our healthcare dollar in this country is spent on after you're sick care and 2% on prevention and wellness. In that prevention and wellness capacity, eating a great diet is a huge part of that. And so it links together with our school programs, with the food stamp programs, with the WIC programs, which has been very obvious how important that is to young kids' developmental process. So I think what we're doing is we're seeing some convergence. We're starting to see that the results of not doing things right are not good. To be 51st is not good in the state on the food stamp program. To watch the child obesity within the schools and some of the other problems with poor diet, is that acceptable? And I think what we're starting to see is a large group of folks, and you mentioned the reauthorization of the Child Nutrition Act, a coalition of folks starting to work together, similar to what happened with the Farm Bill. Mm-hmm. I'm a big believer when people all work together, you can change things that people thought you can't change. And certainly Michael's group and many of the others that we've been working with have been able to prove that, no, indeed, you can change, and you can change pretty rapidly if we kind of get our vision in set.
Mm-hmm. Paula Jones, how do we address this sort of flip sides of the coin, the hunger on one side and the obesity on the other?
Well, I think Secretary Calamora talked about it. It's obesity often is in communities that are lacking in resources. So it's a symptom of poverty. And how do you link them? I mean, you really have to go back to the root cause of poverty, I think. And I think that's, you know, a question that we're not necessarily going to answer today. but it's certainly, like, making sure that people have access to high-quality food. Now, what many researchers have studied this and shown that nutrient-dense food like fruits and vegetables, actually cost a lot more than energy-dense foods that are high in fat and sugar. And, you know, that's a problem with us. And some of the, you know, the food bank has done an incredible job of bringing in fresh produce straight from the packers into the city and incredible tonnages of the food. That's one of the solutions. I think through school lunch, as Paul talked about, and school meals in general is another huge opportunity. We do have salad bars in our middle and high schools here in San Francisco, and that was funded, really initiative of the mayor. The city put up the money for the school district to do that. I think we need more of that kind of community involvement into these major feeding programs because there's problems. There's reasons that there may not be what we want them to be, and a lot of it is a lack of investment, a lack of attention, lack of a community conversation and support for them. And it will take more money to do business here in San Francisco, as we all know, costs a lot more than, you know, where I'm from, Newton, Illinois. It costs a lot more to do business here. And we're all getting the same federal reimbursements, whether you're in Newton, Illinois or San Francisco, California. And that's not going to give us the ideal program that we want. So, you know, I think that really getting the community engaged in some of these solutions, and we're starting to do that, especially around school meals. I see some people here who are part of those conversations. It's a good thing to have.
Michael Dimock, can you speak a little bit to these programs through the schools that are addressing both nutrition and education and how they fit into the broader picture?
Well, actually, I think that we are on the cusp of maybe some really important things around school food. It's been demonstrated now that if you add a garden, you build a curriculum. It has a great impact on children, and that affects their thinking. And that thinking will lead to, hopefully, the right kind of policy eventually when they grow up, because they'll understand the issues. But I think that this state is probably ready for some really good legislation that would support more investment in school food. I'm very hopeful. There are people talking about it. I think it's... The question is, you know, as a society, how do we decide to divvy up our resources? Where are we going to invest in? And I just spent the last 4 days at the Kellogg Conference and the Kellogg Foundation. And the Kellogg Foundation has been the biggest funder of work, the kind of work that Roots of Change does, sustainable agriculture work and sustainable food systems work. They've been the primary funder of that work for probably 20 years. And now they've shifted their focus. They're not abandoning food, but they're making children and the ability for children to thrive their primary focus. And they understand that food is central to that. And they, I think, are also making a very wise decision about the future. We're going into a very difficult time with climate change, all the global conflict issues, peak oil, all those issues. It is so important that we invest well in our children right now because they are going to have to go through something very difficult. It's going to be a passage of the species, I believe. And we have to invest in our children, and they have to understand the complexity of the world, and they have to be healthy enough to go through it. And I think that people are beginning to realize that, and foundations are lining up. And so I'm hoping that here in the state of California, there is going to be a coalition emerging in the next year or so that will start to craft some really good policy to make sure that we have the resources as a state to feed our children well. And that's going to involve child nutrition reauthorization. How are we going to do that? It's going to involve the health department, education department. But that's my big hope for school food.
A.G. Calmore, you've been a supporter of school gardens. And what role does education play in feeding the hungry?
It's going to play more and more of an important role. I don't know how many gardeners you have out in the audience here. I imagine quite a few. But we ask that question often. How many of you are gardeners? Can you recognize that a farmer is kind of a professional gardener? He doesn't make many mistakes, or otherwise he doesn't stay in business very long. And what the educational problem I think that I see, and I think this might be not quite in the subject area that you talked about or you were asking about, is that when 2% of the public currently is engaged in agriculture, production agriculture, 2% out of this country is you know, basically growing food fiber or fuel, as the case might be, and 98% of the people are eating it all the time. So we live in this wonderful luxury of abundance, but that's a shrinking amount of people that are growing the food. What we do see is some great opportunities for, really, I'd like to say, a parallel converging system wherein, here's a good as an example, our food systems for custom growing for a food bank could be manned by young folks that are learning how to grow and become farmers. And they could have a nice system working that helps allow for this new future generation of agriculturalists that can come out and recognize that we're going to have some struggling times if climate is changing, if there's other kinds of tools. And I think that's an important point where we can go with education. Education is kind of the fundamental infrastructural piece. I don't let me carry it all away here, but sustainability, they talk about three E's. You have environment, protecting the environment, and agriculturally we recognize that. You recognize that there's social equity, unjust social justice issues. We recognize that there's economics. Farmers usually, you know, it's an investment of your personal wealth to be in agriculture. It's a risk. It's a gamble. And if you can't keep there unless you're funded from some other source, you go out of business. The fourth, though, is education. You have to be able to learn how to actually work the soil, work this. And I think those four things, when you're paying attention to those, that's the foundation upon which you build this great sustainable future for ourselves in this area of agriculture. And I think there's some great opportunities to expand on that with the utilization of the dollars that we're willing to put into our feeding systems.
You are listening to a Commonwealth Club program on a new national food policy, but what about the hungry? Panelists tonight are A.G. Kawamura, Secretary, California Department of Food and Agriculture, Paula Jones, the Director of Food Systems in San Francisco's Department of Public Health, Paul Ash, Executive Director, San Francisco Food Bank, and Michael Dimock, President, Roots of Change. Paula Jones, this discussion about agriculture and engaging agriculture at the state level, what's happening here at the city level? We've heard a little bit about this urban-rural roundtable, but can you tell us a little bit more? What are the goals of this, and how is it going so far?
Well, actually, the urban-rural roundtable was an idea Michael came up with and pitched it to the mayor's office, and then we had the go-ahead to go ahead and launch this roundtable. And the roundtable has actually already met and have come up with a set of recommendations. It's actually the first time that I think the city has reached out to the areas outside of city boundaries to talk about food and to talk about agriculture. I mean, we have quite a long history of talking about it amongst ourselves in the city and coming up with recommendations or policies around certain things. But I don't think that we have ever really reached out to try to see how can we link to our regional producers and our farmers out there. So at this point, we have a set of recommendations that are going to be public somewhat soon that have been presented to the mayor. They talk about some things as just supporting other regional efforts to create sustainability plans, to protect certain farmlands. Some things talk about that, where the city would play a supportive role. Other things are more that the city actually has to do something within our boundaries. One recommendation really focused on school meals, because it is, like, viewed, and Paul and I have talked a lot about this, what is one of the things the city could do first around hunger? And, you know, we keep coming back to we need to really invest more in our school meal program and really build the capacity of that program to bring in more regional produce, to serve more kids. So the recommendations sort of focus, some of them focus on the city, some of them focus on how we can support regional and state efforts to protect farmland, to support small farmers, to increase sustainability. It's sort of holistic in the approach.
Michael Dimock, thinking about this move towards local and integrating what's happening outside of the city into the city, where do you see the most opportunity when it comes to feeding the hungry for that relationship?
Well, it's interesting. Cities... Civilization exists because of agriculture. Civilization is defined by the fact that we have agricultural production. And that relationship between the countryside that supports the city and the city itself is really fundamental. I'm going to get to this in a second, exactly what you asked, but there's something I think important. There was a great piece in the Chronicle, I don't know how many people saw it, it was maybe 2 or 3 weeks ago, in which it described how much compost was being produced in this city and how much of that compost was ending up on farms. It was 20,000, I think it was 20,000 tons of compost on 10,000 acres of land. That was a really interesting statistic and an interesting story, because it talked about the interrelationship, the actual interdependence of these two worlds. It was on the front page of the Chronicle. You would have loved it. The thing that made me think about is that the cities, they could actually, and the reason we did the roundtable was because they're the solution set, as the Secretary might describe it, for dealing with hunger. A big piece of that has to do with how we utilize the food that's around us. Before the session began, I was listening to a very interesting conversation go on about broccoli and how when the price of broccoli falls too far, the growers can't even harvest it because they'll lose money. So a program is being designed around the ability to harvest that broccoli at cost, where the food bank would cover the cost for the workers to go out. And the farmer doesn't cost him anything to get it done, but then that food becomes available to the food bank and the community. Now, to the extent that we build the relationships between farmers and food banks, farmers and cities, that kind of thing can happen in a great multitude. So our goal is to take what is happening here in San Francisco, which is just beginning really, and do it in the 6 largest metropolitan areas in the state. Because if you could get the 6 largest metropolitan areas of the state to start thinking about their food sheds and start leveraging those kinds of opportunities, I think you could have real change.
Paul Ash, what's your thinking on this issue in terms of the food banks, which are already obviously involved with agriculture, but getting more involved, whether it's this gleaning or harvesting? How do you see that happening or not happening?
Well, that's already happening all across the state, thanks to the Association of Food Banks and the Farm to Family program. So we're trying to grow things that happen locally as examples and make them at least statewide models, maybe national models at some point. The closer the relationship between urban and rural, the better. There's no question about that. But when I think of low-income people, I think of people who oftentimes need to get their food in conventional. I know that's a bad word, but I mean going to a store and buying some of their food. And that's a worry that we have, because there's only so much we can do at the food bank, providing food, farmers market style at schools and churches, places like that. Food stamps has never been meant to be a full feeding program for people. It's always been supplementary. School meals only happen at schools and only happen for children. So we have all these pieces, but there needs to be some opportunity for people to be able to purchase food in a conventional way, to build in between the other things that government and nonprofit organizations can do for them.
Well, I have to say, as a San Francisco resident, I'm often dismayed at the cost of food in our supermarkets, which is where most people are shopping. I shop at the farmers market, too, and sometimes the farmers market is cheaper than the supermarket. But the supermarket remains the way most people get their food these days and will be for quite some foreseeable future. What would you like to see in terms of the city helping to make supermarkets more affordable, more competitive, especially within San Francisco?
Yeah, affordability is a huge issue for folks. I went into a supermarket today just to look around and kind of get my bearings in terms of price, and it's surprising how expensive things are. I was particularly surprised by the differential between conventionally grown product and organic grown product, and that's the two things we have now to measure. There's nothing really in between. Oranges were 99 cents a pound for conventionally grown, $2.39 for the organic grown. So there's this huge discrepancy when you start to look at food that is grown in that more caring, smaller scale, probably, hopefully, more regional way. So I think we need to get those prices closer together if we want people, particularly low-income people, to be able to participate in this kind of change in the food systems.
Paula Jones, is this something that the city can help to solve this problem with the supermarkets?
I think in general, it's It's a little bit hard. The food retail sector has been consolidating, as we all know. And so we have certain areas of the city that don't have supermarkets or that supermarkets are planning to leave. I don't know. I think it's hard for a city to solve this on its own. I think we have people who have been really trying in some of our departments. And what I've seen happen that has been successful is when there's a statewide approach taken to it. In Pennsylvania, they passed a bond. This was been probably 5 years ago, that created a fund of money that would go to develop food retail in low-income areas. And that money was then given to, say, Philadelphia, that was able to use their local money with the state money and leverage and attract some retailers into places that they didn't, food retailers didn't really want to go. So I think it's a little bit difficult to solve food retailing from just the city perspective. I think what we could do is definitely really work on the food stamp issue, making sure that we have as many people that are eligible for food stamps, signed up for food stamps, that would create more money when you do go to the grocery store. And I think we have to really be thankful for our emergency food net or our charitable feeding system, whatever you call it, that actually provides, how many food pantries do we have now, Paul?
We have 200 food pantries.
There's 200 food pantries, and those are places and communities that people go to get food, and that's free food. And I think a lot of times people forget that that's happening, and usually when I'm in a crowd and I ask that question to people, you know, I try to get an answer, and a lot of people say, oh, there's probably 15, there's 10, and when I say 200, I mean the eyes, you know, get huge and the jaws drop. So, you know, I would like to see more of a regional and a state approach to food retailing. I think that, you know, we're a city that's really progressive and trying, but it's really hard to attract food retailers into areas that they don't perceive as being as profitable as maybe some suburban areas might be.
Could I interject? Because there may be something we could learn from another sector. I read all the time in the newspaper about the housing market. If you want to build housing in San Francisco, you're required to lose money. In some of it. You're required to build housing and sell it below market. I'm not sure why we can't adopt that kind of approach with food, because we have plenty of people selling food here in San Francisco, presumably making money, and the next time they want to expand or do something different, maybe they need to agree to locate in a different area and help out the city and its residents in that way. So maybe there's models of trading off with supermarkets and other companies that sell food in that way.
Sounds like a great idea. Mm-hmm. Michael Dimock, what is your thought in terms of lowering the cost of food that has been grown in a more sustainable way? So sustainable agriculture, yes, but sustainable for and affordable. How do we create this affordability?
Well, Paul said something very important a few minutes ago. He talked about the fact that right now we have a system where you can identify two ends of a spectrum, organic and conventional. But that's not really reality. That's the simple version that most all the world believes. He said that because the reality is there are many production systems now that you can't really call conventional. I would call them the term I like to use, which probably would never be accepted by the larger population, is biologically integrated farming systems. And why do I say that? It's because the science is evolved so far, and the understanding of plant pathology and plant systems and soil has and our ability to work with those, leverage the natural systems, has evolved to a place where there can be a real minimal amount of inputs into a farming system. So you can reduce pesticide use by 90%. We have data on this. This was the legislature in the state of California spent a lot of money in the 1990s through the University of California and a lot of NGOs working together to develop the system. And that is really, to me, we talk about this, is the solution that we need. We need to scale those systems up and allow people, because they can provide food at a price that could feed large blocks of a population at a price that's affordable.
And actually, we have a question for the Secretary A.G. Kawamura about the cost of organic, sustainable produce. and how it's sufficiently, how it's so much high, significantly higher than conventional produce. Do you see a tipping point for reversing this at some point in the future?
You know, I'm a grower down in Orange County. We do both organic and conventional growing there. And I think one of the biggest challenges, I think I mentioned earlier, when you're engaged in agriculture as an occupation, not as a hobby, not as a funded side business, your costs then become very, very important. The cost of water, if you don't own the ground, what's the cost of rent? The inputs that you do have to buy, whether they're organic or not, the regulatory burden that you carry, certainly the labor protocols that we have in our state, which are second to none, all of these increase the cost of food, and your yield then is the one thing you'd get to divide back your cost. Here's your cost, and what your yield per acre is a very important part of how much that one unit of broccoli or one unit of celery or the tree of strawberries, what did it cost based upon your production costs all throughout the harvest, the transportation, the cooling. There's an infrastructure that you have to have in place to get it to market, transportation, whether it's a pickup truck or a semi. All of those costs are what drives our national global marketplace as far as how much food costs. And I think Paul said this at early on in this discussion, is that we really can't lose sight of the fact that ultimately as you produce food, whether it's being subsidized by a government or not, and in California, the specialty crops side of things, which is 90-something percent of all the products we produce in California are specialty crops, they don't get a direct subsidy of any sort. It just has never been there. The grain crops do, right? What we're seeing is the cost of food, the fact that we spend as a nation 9 to 10% as an average of our income on food is one picture. We know, though, if you're at the lower end of the income scale, you're spending 10, 20, 25, 30% of your income on food. And when there's no access to it in an inner city or in a rural area, we call those food deserts, where there's no access. You're buying a liquor store diet because that's all that's available. That needs to be dealt with and can be dealt with because that's some of the most expensive and maybe not the most nutrient-dense, certainly, food you'll find is that liquor store diet, if you will, the convenience store diet. And so how can that change would be something that you have to look at in terms of this cost structure. Subsidized food, it's something that's very difficult to try and get to when we have in our country and in so many places a market system driving these costs. It's supply and demand. When you have too much organic zucchini on the market, you can get it very cheap. Mm-hmm. When you have too much organic broccoli on the market or too much conventional, you have guys right now that are disking down fields of broccoli not harvested because the price has been driven so cheap because we have so much supply. There's good growing conditions. And it's an imperfect system. You'd rather see abundance than scarcity. And that goes back to this understanding of the dynamics, I think, that agriculture has. That being said, local areas, local regions, states can create imaginative systems that help use the resources you have. We're an amazing resource full state. We have 400 different products we grow. You can imagine in the winter in North Dakota and some of these other places, they have a lot less choices from their local ag community unless they drive themselves into greenhouses. And you're starting to see that happen. And you're seeing some really neat things taking place within the new technologies that will marry together with this idea that we must have a predictable food supply. I don't know if I answered the question. I go on and on, but the point is the cost of food is always going to be driven by the cost to produce it and get it onto a plate. And it's not difficult who will pick up that cost any system driven by costs.
And the demand as well, the supply
and demand.
Absolutely. Well, Michael Dimock, you spoke a little bit about in the future paying rural farmers differently than we're paying them. Not that the subsidies will go away, but that they will be different than they are today. Mm-hmm. Can you expand on this idea?
Well, there is in federal law a series of policies that provide farmers a set of payments for doing stewardship work. As the Secretary mentioned, sustainability in agriculture means it has three components. And one of those components is the ecological work associated with it, because agriculture is the one kind of the most impactful activity that humans have on the natural world. And so it's imperative that we do it in a way that doesn't damage the environment. And we know a lot about how to do that now. The problem is we live in a world in which our farmers here in the United States have to compete with farmers all around the world who have lower costs. So public policy is about trying to level the playing field in one way. So it seems to me that the smart thing for us to do, and there is policy there, and the issue is how do we increase the amount of public investment in this piece of the farm bill, or maybe a state bill. How do we get farmers to receive a payment that allows them to deliver a product to the marketplace at a world price, but not damage the environment? Because if they have to produce cheap food in order to compete in the world, they're going to have to cut costs in whatever way they can. So what we want to do is keep them from having to cut costs and damage the environment. So if we pay them to have riparian corridors so that there's a lot of trees along the rivers to keep the rivers clean and keep species, that's a really good thing. If we pay them to use cover crops rather than artificial nitrogen, if we pay them to no-till farming systems, then we get into a situation that gets to providing them a level playing field in the world and a revenue stream that supplants their need to cut costs and hurt the environment. Right.
Paula Jones, this issue of supply and demand, and we have this overabundance, and yet at the same time we have issues of hunger and people not getting enough to eat. How does the city of San Francisco help to sort of try to bridge that gap?
I would say, I think, again, I go back to being thankful for the food bank, actually, because I think the food bank and our charitable feeding system are picking up a lot of the slack. That's what I see. I think we definitely have food programs that the city runs or the school district runs, and there's actually more collaboration around those. And the more that we have and the more public process and transparency and that people become educated about those is important. I think that we can bring resources to them and accountability and all of that. But at the same time, you know, we have a whole world of nonprofit partners that are really feeding the poor. Some of them are getting funding from the city, and the city actually, our city does fund through Office of Aging additional funds that matches federal funds that I've heard that Alameda County, for example, doesn't do. So I think that there is a commitment there, but it also, there's always a need for the public to be engaged in the issue and to really raise the level of awareness and priority of that issue. So it's both. It's a partnership between the city and the nonprofit community, and it's, you know, it's always sort of it's always changing. And the more people that become involved, there are different groups that are public processes, and people can join in or read the minutes or whatever. There's a food security task force, and that group is really starting to look at how can we have. You know, how can we take on bigger issues and how can we institutionalize this work? It's a task force format, meaning that it's there for a period of time to do a task, but we're realizing hunger and food insecurity is not going away. So how do we institutionalize that? How do we create a public forum for people to be able to engage, whether it's come to a meeting or read meeting minutes, to really start to, you know, be there to talk to the supervisors and say, you know, we think this is a priority. So it's, you know, we are doing a lot as a city, and I think that we're thankful for the partners that we have in the community.
When it comes to engaging the public, Paul Ash, what would you like to see citizens, especially here in San Francisco, doing to help both raise awareness and to help alleviate the issues of hunger?
Well, we always talk about three things that individuals can do. They can donate. Obviously, nonprofit organizations need that kind of support, donating to organizations that are feeding, that have ideas about how we should feed people. We want people to volunteer because there's lots of hands-on opportunities. Food is something that doesn't happen in a laboratory or in a factory. It happens and needs human hands. We had 14,000 different people come down to volunteer last year at the food bank. I know our pantries and other fellow feeding organizations were using people also. But maybe people's biggest opportunity is to become advocates, to be thinking about low-income people, to be thinking about food systems, to be thinking, in a way, about the priorities we talked about a minute ago. We're in a tough budget situation. Federal, state, local, all the way around. So it really is a trade-off for almost anything we do. There's not a lot of new money out there. So we have to decide what's important to us. And I think when people start thinking about that, food and feeding people will come up higher than it is today. Now, that's the point where it's much better to be the food bank director than to be the secretary of agriculture or the mayor or the supervisor, because those are tough choices to make. But I think when individuals, people who go to work every day, don't necessarily think as much as they should about food and the hungry, start getting involved, we can change those priorities. And more money will flow to school meals, to food stamps, to agricultural education in our schools, those kinds of programs that I think are really important to people.
Well, speaking of food activism, I feel like we should turn to Michael Dimock here. Tell us, what is the status of the food declaration? How many signatures are you up to? And what are some of the key elements on that declaration? What are things that, again, the citizens can do to help bring about these changes that you'd like to see?
Well, the declaration, actually, we were just looking today, it's approaching 19,000. It's not that many yet, because we haven't really... We did a big push at the introduction of the declaration last fall, but we are actually tonight, after this, having a conversation about the next round and what we're going to be doing. So in the next few months, we're going to launch a viral campaign. There are a lot of people that probably don't know what the declaration is. The Declaration for Healthy Food and Agriculture is a preamble, 12 principles, and a call to action. And what it basically says is that we have had a framework for agricultural policy in the United States, which was incredibly successful. I mean, when historians look back on this 100 years from now, 200 years from now, 1,000 years, they're going to go, wow, that was incredible. When we decided we need to produce cheap calories and feed the nation, we did it. And we did it in about 60 or 70 years. And it was an incredible thing. It showed how really ingenious humans are. We produced a massive amount of food. What we didn't think about were the unintended consequences, and we now know what they are. It's obesity, it's destruction of the environment in certain ways. And so now we need a policy that frames agriculture's goals differently. We need a healthy, we need health as the outgrowth of agriculture. And that's what this declaration does. So it has 12 principles that describe, if they were followed, if policies emerged from those 12 principles, we would have a framework for a healthy system.
So after signing the declaration,
yes,
are there one or two things that you would like to see folks do on a daily
yes,
basis?
Yes. Paul said one thing that I think is really important. There are a million nonprofit organizations in this country. Not a million, but there are actually probably hundreds now, maybe thousands. I don't know. There are people in the room who may know this, that are now working to create a more healthy food system. And those groups need support. So pick one and become an advocate, become a donor, become a supporter, show up. When you're lucky enough to have a secretary like we have who's thinking about how to move the system forward and calls public sessions, go to those sessions, show up, speak your mind, let him know, because that empowers him to make change. So those are the things. And then also shop. Shop in a different way. Buy those things that you think are manifestations or reflect the values or the kind of food system you want. And then I think you said something really good, Paul, about going and helping feed people. I think that's a beautiful experience for every human being to have. If you've never done it before, go to a food bank, go to a kitchen, and feed people. Be part of that. That's an incredible experience for all of us. It reminds us of what's really important.
We have time for one last question, and A.G. Calmora, I'd like to put it to you again, this question of what can the citizens of California do? We've heard how they can support the food bank. We've heard how they can kind of vote with their fork and make decisions at that level. What else can they do? Is there anything else that we're missing that would support your vision for the future?
Michael just covered really quite a bit about it. The dollar you spend, I say this many times, how wonderful, what a privilege is to have this luxury of abundance in this country, in our state especially, that we have. We get to choose so many different kinds of foods, so many different kinds of food production systems, and yet we also know that as we're fighting, sometimes we have food fights, you know, about what kind of food should be on the plate and how it should be produced on that plate and how it should get to the plate. We know that there's an enormous amount of people, billions, basically, would just like to have something predictably on the plate on a regular basis. I'll continue to say that don't ever think that the luxury of abundance is a given thing. even for our state, there's plenty of things that can shut down a food system, a region, overnight, an earthquake, a water system breach, a disease, a plague. You know, these things do happen, and they happen regularly around the planet, and hopefully they don't continue to happen more and more. When I say that, then, I think this idea that the culture of agriculture is something that we need to reinvent for this 21st century, where community recognizes, urban communities, that rural or even urban center, the folks that are producing those foods, we're all stakeholders in that a positive outcome. When agriculture is thriving, then we have that abundance. Then you have growers that want to be in that business. They don't want to sell their land and get it developed because they're going out of business. You have ability to start to really protect that resource, which is your agricultural base, the soil underneath, which drives it all. And I think at this point what's happening is we really need a call to all citizens to try and recognize that food supply has threats, and one of the biggest threats is ignorance. Investment in public health, like we were saying, when healthcare, 98% of your healthcare dollars spent on after you're sick, think about it this way. There's not a farmer out there that would rather spend 98% of everything he has to make sure the population he's taking care of is thriving. You know, it's a reverse in our country. It's not to say spend less on healthcare for the already chronically ill or that side, but in that 2% of prevention and wellness, wouldn't it be great if we started to spend more money on prevention and wellness in this arena of nutrition, and that as an investment, you'll see a return. It's not a cost, it's an investment, because you'll see a return in healthy people, less people that are chronically ill, and you'll start to see that turnaround. And that's where I think we have a chance with this, if you will, a renaissance of agriculture, is where you start to see this really wonderful future, because we have options, because we have technologies, because we have newfound or remembered technologies or sciences. That's exciting, I think. And so I would encourage the public, as I say, to join in on the different food movements. Choose a movement, that's okay. But get engaged with that, because ultimately you're a stakeholder. The outcome of that, successful outcome of those food movements, help you as a citizen. And I think putting your dollars involving and being involved in community, this community that we all share, is part of this future for us. And I know that agriculture, if it's doing well, allows an awful lot of good things to happen locally, statewide, and nationally and globally.
And on that note, I'd like to thank each of the panelists. You've been listening to a Commonwealth Club program on a new national food policy, but what about the hungry, with Secretary of the California Department of Food and Agriculture, A.G. Kawamura, Paula Jones, the Director of Food Systems in the San Francisco Department of Public Health, Paul Ash, Executive Director of the San Francisco Food Bank, and Michael Dimock, President of Roots of Change.